evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And now, will the estimated 11 million immigrants, will the working class be scalded as stew of immigration bills reaches boiling point? And with us to discuss the issues that seem to be reaching a crescendo this week are Jeffrey Foe, co-founder of Economic Policy Institute and author of The Global Class War, Hector Figueroa, secretary-treasurer of SEIU, a local 32BJ, Nancy Morowick, co-director of the NYU School of Law Immigrants' Rights Clinic, and Ariana Renteria Torres, supervising attorney, immigrant law unit of the Westchester Hispanic Coalition, and Marianne Yang, director of NYSDA Immigrant Defense Project, and I would say people who are very well situated to discuss this issue. And some of the things that we need to know, of course, are the onerous provisions that exist really in all of the bills that are being proposed. But maybe we can start with Jeff.
Jeff, you've just finished this book, The Global Class War, and as I've been seeing the news reporting on the immigration phenomenon in the United States, I don't see too much emphasis on looking at the global perspective, and especially the various trade agreements that the United States has entered into with, for instance, Mexico and Canada, CAFTA, Central America. Bring us up to speed on how this affects immigration to the United States.
Well, I think that immigration is part of the globalization process. And, specifically, you can look at the failure and see the failure of the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was the prototype, which was the model for the World Trade Organization and the global trade rules. You can see its failure in the problem of illegal immigration, undocumented workers coming across to the United States, risking their lives for jobs that may or may not even reach the minimum wage. It's a reflection of the failure of the so-called free trade agenda to do what it was promised. When NAFTA was first debated, Bill Clinton, and I'm quoting now, said there will be less illegal immigration because Mexicans will be able to support their children by staying home. Well, that didn't happen. Carlos Salinas, who was a Mexican president at the time, came to Washington during those years and asked Americans, well, you have a choice between Mexican tomatoes or Mexican tomato pickers. It was very, raw and right up front that they were making this appeal that it would stop this illegal immigration from Mexico. Of course, it didn't, because it didn't create a middle-class prosperity in Mexico. And so immigration across from Mexico, undocumented workers coming in, have more than doubled since NAFTA was first put there. So what we're arguing about in the immigration bill and all the politics around it really is a reflection of the failure of the kind of globalization policies that we've been pursuing and in a large extent led the world in pursuing. Failure of those policies to deliver. So suddenly we're faced with this problem here, the politics of it, the tragedies of it, because we haven't solved the basic issues of how we're going to operate in this global economy. You look at the difference between how we have integrated North America and how the Europeans integrated Western Europe, and you learned some very important lessons. That when the European Union was first started, the French and the Germans and the Dutch, there was a lot of fear there because they thought they'd be overwhelmed by poor migrants from Greece and Spain and Portugal and even Ireland. And it didn't happen. And it didn't happen because part of the deal was a generous transfer of investment funds for roads, for schools, for infrastructure, housing, and clean water from the rich countries to the poor ones. And second, the poor countries had to agree to abide by certain labor standards and human rights standards. That was absent from NAFTA. And in some ways, we're reaping the rewards right now.
Well, maybe this will glide seamlessly into Hector Figueroa, who is our labor expert, so to speak, today, who is the Secretary-Treasurer of 32BJ. Hector, how do you look at this issue and some of the debate? Of course, what always seems to me to be the case is that we don't enforce wage and hour rules in terms of workers here, which leads to exploitation and sometimes super exploitation. And, of course, those are the issues that are not fueling the debate around immigration. But how does your union and your perspective take hold here? And I should say that Hector is also one of the people who's working very aggressively towards the April 10th demonstration on immigrants' rights. Hector?
Well, thank you. Now we have a very high standard to pursue. I agree with Jeff, if I may, on this issue of how globalization has really been met by ill-conceived policies like NAFTA, and that, you know, the deep root of the problem of immigration is that we have not addressed development in Mexico and the issue of workers' rights across the border and here in the States. But we also now have this reality of a million people who are here working in this country. Most of them are workers, just like you and me, trying to make a living. And we have seen in Congress a response in this H.R. 4437 bill, sponsored by Sansenbrenner, our own local elected official, Peter Kim from Long Island, that virtually creates a state of a clearly underclass worker that not only will be exploited, but also now will become a federal felon. And those who try to improve the life of these workers become federal felons too. This has taken a different turn in the Senate, but the way it looks to us is the turn that you take when you know that you're heading into the abyss, and then you change in the other direction, but you're still swimming against the current. What's been happening in the Senate is not yet what we need in this country, but it's a good step forward in the sense that now the discussion is moving politically towards legalization and to figure out how we deal with future flows of workers, although the solution that have been presented thus far fell short of what we would call comprehensive immigration reform.
Now, Nancy and I were coming up together in the elevator, and one of the things that was just very casually said is, my goodness, it looks like what we're really moving to is less of legalization, et cetera, but more of the worst of each of the bills being synthesized during this next week. And certainly I want to ask our other guests what their perspective and understanding of what we may wind up with, and of course, what are the terrifying pitfalls within that for the immigrant communities. Nancy, I'm going to start with you since you made the offhand comment.
Well, I think the first thing that's very important to understand is that the enforcement provisions in the Senate are in many ways just as bad as the enforcement provisions in the House. People tend to think the Senate bill is much more pro-immigrant because it does have programs for legalization, and that's, of course, a very important part of that bill. But under the Senate bill, people who help people, you know, neighbors with babysitting, help a neighbor find a job, people who just do ordinary day-to-day human things will be criminalized just as they would be under the House bill. And in addition to that, there are many, many sort of basic human rights. I mean, rights to be brought before a judge if you're stopped on the street and charged with deportation, rights to sort of get fair process, to go to a court. There are many, many rights that are undermined by this bill. It's a bill that promotes detention and deportation in, you know, all through the bill. Now, the bill, when it came out, the final version of the Senate Judiciary bill is 477 pages long, and nobody actually got to sit down and look at the fine print until last Thursday. And when you started to look at that fine print, I mean, there were, just to give you an example, there was one provision that people tried to get in last year in the Real ID debate, which was a big debate last year on immigration law, and the conference committee didn't allow it. And suddenly this provision, which, you know, it might sound technical, but it has to do with whether you can get a court to stop deportation, you know, when you go to court, is back in, and it's snuck into a provision, you know, where you would never guess that it was inside that section of the bill. And that's the kind of problem we have, and I'm very worried that, you know, that even if we only had the Senate's enforcement provisions, it would be very bad.
I agree. A lot of us think that the laws in 1996 were horrible. They were a full-out assault on immigrants and were particularly horrible to lawful permanent residents who were living here for decades. And overnight, we saw, you know, working-class mothers being deported without any form of discretionary deportation waiver for such ridiculously minor offenses like shoplifting, you know, diapers or baby clothes worth $15. And basically those laws devastated entire immigrant communities, which are full of, you know, U.S. citizen family members as well. And there has been some coverage of H.R. 4437 and the bad enforcement provisions in the Sensenbrenner bill in the House, but I think it is high time for us to talk about how horrible these enforcement provisions are in the Senate bill that passed the Judiciary Committee, and also the FRIST bill, which is technically on the floor of the Senate as well. They expand the grounds of deportation. They authorize the use of domestic military bases for increased detention. They authorize local law enforcement to make calls on whether someone might be here unlawfully or not. Local law authorities generally having really no expertise at all in making those determinations. And a whole host of other things that basically in their totality create this mechanism to delegalize already lawfully residing people here in the U.S. And I question a policy that purports to legalize, and I think it would only legalize mere fraction of the 11 or 12 million undocumented people here in the United States. But I question that policy to legalize just to turn around and make it that much easier to delegalize those same people tomorrow.
So we bring Adriana into the discussion as well, and in part because certainly you've spent considerable amounts of time in Mexico. Some of the immigration reality in the country is focused on Mexico, and I was hoping that you would add your voice to this discussion. And
I think that it's unfortunate to have yet another example of a fragmented policy towards migrants that give us the idea that this is the mechanism that is going to include or to bring 11 million people into the mainstream of protection and access to benefits in this country, and it does quite the contrary. It's yet another example of a law that refuses to assume accountability from the part of the administration for the ill-conceived, as has been said, policies that the regional policies that the United States has been advancing in Mexico and Central America since the 1980s. The reality is that immigration is not going to stop until the United States assumes the responsibility for the causes that generate the displacement of workers, the lack of opportunity and advancement for professionals in their own country, and that make us believe or try to make the population of the United States believe that immigration is a border security issue, that is a national and security issue that is going to be addressed with border security measures and requires that the United States administration assumes a warlike stance towards migrants. We have heard in the last 10 years programs such as Gatekeeper, Hold the Line, programs that really try to deter people from coming into the United States through force and aggression, programs that were designed by the Department of State of Defense, law conflict or law level conflict department, that want to push at the solution for the presence of migrants in our communities is to push them by force rather than addressing the reasons why here in the first place. NAFTA and CAFTA are one of the examples of the reasons why these people are here and where Central Americans and Mexico try to look into a better life in the United States rather than trying to create the conditions for sufficiency and self-sufficiency in their own countries. Since NAFTA was enacted, the engineers of NAFTA foresaw this displacement of peasants and the destruction of the economy. Basically, the small businesses, small business owners went lost their property, lost their enterprises to allow NAFTA to take over land, to take over the wealth, the raw materials that are necessary to sustain the economy of the Mexican state. So it's unfortunately to see yet another try at something that history has proved that has failed, a fragmented policy, a fragmented deal that also tries to separate undocumented migrants, the worked workers that work the fields, from the less worthy migrants, those who might have a criminal record. And I think that's creating division among advocates and division in the community.
Can I follow up on that? I think this is really important to give the listeners a sense of just how this thing, you know, works. One of the examples here in NAFTA was that the treaty called for the expansion of the exports from corn and wheat in the U.S. and Canada to Mexico. And even at the time of NAFTA, it was clear to everybody that this was going to hurt the small Mexican farmer who grows the corn and has a little co-op in the town and doesn't have a great life, but was able to survive. And when they opened the door to the flood of U.S. corn and Canadian wheat, it just blew, some of the estimates are 2 million farmers, just blew them out of the water in Mexico. And this was no accident. In my book, I have quotes from Mexican officials who said that's exactly what we wanted. We wanted to push people off the farm and put them, you know, move them into the cities, where they could be, and essentially, a low-wage labor force for industrial growth. Well, what happened, of course, is that most of the benefits of this kind of thing in Mexico went to the rich. The middle class actually shrunk, and you had workers displaced from the rural areas, no place to go in Mexico to find jobs, and so they came north. And it's not just that it was a mistake in policy. If you go back and read the documents and read those speeches, it's clear that that's how it was designed. So, you know, what seems now to be, well, gee, you know, this sort of disaster that's come up is not the result of an accident. And so the notion that this country and the leadership in this country has some responsibility here for what's been done, I think, is very, very important.
One of the ingredients that we've been missing so far is the guest worker program. It was introduced in the Kevin McCain bill, but sort of the Vector hybrid, I call it, has a version of it also. And Hector, do you want to start a discussion on that?
Well, I'd like to make a discussion connected to what Jeff said. I agree with Marianne and Nancy about the bad provisions of this legislation, but I do not think this is really a result of fortune. It's not unfortunate. This is, like Jeff is saying, the natural consequence of how this integration has been moving forward, and also of the coincidence of factors here. You know, on the one hand, you have a heavy flow of immigrants from Mexico and other parts of the world. It's not just Mexico, and I think we should not restrict ourselves to Mexico, you know, because people are coming from Eastern Europe, from Africa, from Latin America. But also it coincided at the very moment in which the assault on working people in this country continued and was consolidated in the way that our economy has been functioning. Inequality is increased. Many of our traditional social contract, if you want to call it that way, have been eroded. Unions have been losing their power. Workers have been seeing the loss of health care, pension, happening at the very moment in which immigration is flowing in large numbers. So you have now a public out there that, unless we organize it and educate, a portion of the public can be easily directed by those who want to see immigrants as the culprit, to see immigrants as those who are partly responsible for our problem, as opposed to those who really are behind the way our economy functions and our government tries to to come up with the way to govern in this environment. And I think that it is those circumstances that are partly responsible for this kind of legislation. It's very bad in terms of enforcement. It's very bad in many ways. But what I think we should not underestimate is because of the actions that have been happening over the last few weeks, because of the pressure from the bottom, you know, the discourse has to shift in some way. Not too far away from the abyss, not too far away from the black hole that we were headed, but still, you know, changing in the direction of trying to talk about legalization. And, you know, the guest worker program is an example again. We could talk about individual provisions, but the way that we think about it in the labor movement is that we need to put tremendous pressure on the streets right now on making clear what we need. Legalization with a path to citizenship, worker protection, protection of civil rights, reunification of families. Even if those things are not contained in the way that we need in this legislation, because the process may end with no legislation. There may be no reconciliation of the Senate and the House bill. And we need to continue to raise our voices and organize ourselves for the long-term fight.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's also a reason for a framework for which to look at some of the enforcement provisions. Because one of the things about the enforcement provisions is that they really act as impediments to that path to citizenship. And one example which has received no attention at all is that the bills create new bars to citizenship and for the first time in American history allow the government agency on its own to deny somebody citizenship. So in a sense, it's giving the power to have more and more second-class citizens, people who are always at risk of detention and deportation and not really able to reach citizenship and be able to participate as voters in the United States.
I agree. That's one great example. And it's just one of many in the Senate legislation, either in the chairman's mark that passed the judiciary or the first bill, that includes these punitive mechanisms that apply to legal residents here and really have nothing to do, or should have nothing to do, with a debate on how to grapple with the 11 million undocumented immigrants here in the country.
Another way of thinking about it is, you know, and these bills, in a sense, are being designed as massive registration programs. I think the underlying logic of these bills is that you seal the borders as though that were possible. You then require everybody within the country to register, and then you deport all the ones who don't meet the requirements of this program. And that then becomes the logic for imposing criminal penalties on people who are not given these temporary visas and so on. And when you look at the fine print of all of this, it really winds up being largely a report to deport program. Nobody's going to come forward for that, and then people who don't come forward will be all the more marginalized. And I think that's why a true legalization, a true program which gives people a real right to come forward and to obtain status, is what's really needed and what people need to be raising their voices for.
And voices have been raised on those lines. I think that perhaps what I would say is a big strategic challenge right now is, do we focus our efforts in going after the Senate bill and talking about all the negative things in the Senate bill, which I think there are many, and I would never characterize this bill. I don't think anybody who's been organizing in the immigrant communities characterizes this bill as pro-immigrant. But at the same time, we are facing a real, you know, juncture in which it's important that even the shy, weak provisions that the Senate version has try to prevail over this process, so the bill, at a minimum, is not reconcilable with the bill from the House, because then we can certainly get them to become law. And I think that, you know, part of the game that we are in right now is that, unfortunately, a bill that doesn't really grant all the things that we need is out there, which happen to be of a different genetic makeup, even though it has the same features of the bill in the House. The bill in the House is only about enforcement. And the bill in the Senate, with all the problems that it has on enforcement, still raises the issue of legalization, albeit in all these restrictive ways, and the issue of what to do with the future flow. And in some sense, it would be difficult to reconcile the two. So the question is, do we go for a moment in which we try to say no immigration bill should be passed, or should we try to concentrate on the things that we think a legislation should have, so we take this attention, this moment of attention that the country has on the problem of immigration, to A, try to tell the country who the real immigrants are. They're working people just like everybody else. What our basic demands are. And to make sure that those who are thinking about reintroducing this kind of legislation in the future which would probably be the scenario we'd contemplate, pay some political cost for what they're doing. When you look at somebody like Peter King, and you look at Sansenbrenner, and you look at the race in November, one question that we need to ask, are those people going to continue in the House? Are some of those folks continue in the Senate? There is a very strong likelihood that they will. And unless we figure out a way to advance, you know, our agenda in a way that changes the political climate, we're not going to have the bill that we actually need. There is no condition for it to pass now. There are no conditions for it to pass in the immediate future. But there is a huge attention to the problem right now and a strategic need to prevent the version from the House to become law in a way that it reconciles itself with the Senate version.
Llegado la noticia muy alegre que de Veno es diferente, pues el pueblo ya está en contra de los rancheros y engreídos que acababan con la gente.
This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. And Jeff Foe, who is the author of The Global Class War, Hector Figueroa, Secretary Treasurer, SEIU Local 32BJ, Nancy Morrowitt from the NYU School of Law Immigrant Rights Clinics, and Ariana Renteria Torre, Supervising Attorney of the Immigrant Law Unit in Westchester, Hispanic Coalition, and Mariana Yang, Director of NYSDA with the Immigrant Defense Project.
Yeah, this is Jeff Fatt, and I think it's interesting to note what's driving all of this. And one of the things that's driving it is the Republicans' fear of what's going to happen in November. I mean, George Bush is 34% in the polls. Everybody knows that the Republicans are worried. And I think that the reason they push this bill, and it's so brutal and draconian, is that this is an effort to appeal to the Republican base. You know, they're trying to motivate the Republican base, the working class part of the Republican base. And so the idea of a wall, the idea of criminalizing, you know, that's a hard line. But I think that's motivated by politics. The Chamber of Commerce and the sort of business Republicans are, of course, on the other side. You know, their view is as many workers should come over as possible and have no rights and, you know, no privileges. So there's a split in the Republican Party. But my guess is that after this bill is defeated, you know, after November, the politics are going to be different, even if the Republicans maintain control of the House and the Senate. Because I think the business community, after November, is going to get back in more control of the right-wing Republicans. But the Republicans right now feel, in the House, feel desperate. And so a lot of them have gone along with this brutal bill because they don't have anything else to provide for their base in November.
Mm-hmm. Well, but what really worries me is I think we're starting to hear noises from the House and from Senator Frist indicating that some kind of guest worker program might be okay with them. And so I think we could wind up with a House-Senate bill that has some guest worker program, really does nothing for the people who are undocumented in this country, builds fences at the border, increases criminal penalties, and eviscerates judicial review. And it will be seen as a little bit for each side.
Each of those sides. Yeah, I think that is the danger. You're right.
What's the problem with guest workers? We really haven't. We're saying it's bad, but why is it bad?
First of all, I mean, a guest worker program is going to be doing anything for the undocumented population of the country. But more to the point, guest worker programs are always tied to particular employment, and there's enormous potential for abuse of workers in those situations.
I keep thinking one step forward, two steps back, and I have kind of felt that
just two steps.
just that the best thing that could happen this year is leave it alone. Shouldn't we be fighting for no bill, really, and just going back to, if nothing else, our slogans of years past, which is open the borders? Is that a completely naive perspective? And we all have to become pragmatists now?
I say, Mimi, that's a completely naive perspective in the sense that we're not going to be able to move politically that agenda. That being said, we need to go back to the principles. A campaign out there now of resistance to this legislation, which started with the resistance to H.R. 4437, and I don't want my comments to be misunderstood that we should not fight for at least some of the leadership in the Senate to try to introduce amendments on the worst parts of the Senate bill. I think that we should still try to wage that fight. But we need to have a positive fight, too. We need to be able to say what is that we want on comprehensive immigration reform. One of the problems with the Democratic Party, and I've been criticized by some of our elected officials for comments that I've been making throughout this period, is that it's really hard to tell what the Democrats, for example, are advancing in terms of an immigration reform bill. It seems that the word that they're playing is one of very cautious, political calculation. To some extent, they have been able to stop the worst, I would say, aspects of the House bill, and we can have a disagreement over that, perhaps. But we can certainly see that move of being incredibly cautious, and one in which is almost like letting the Republicans fight at each other. Labor, on the other hand, has been quite clear about the basic principles, but it's also divided over the issue of guest workers. Some of the unions don't want any kind of a guest worker program. In our union, SCIU, we've been criticized by this. We say that we need to deal with the future immigration flow. And if that is in the form of a guest worker program in which has strong worker protections and we have a passage to citizenship, it's something that we're very willing to contemplate. Unless somebody can come with a better way of dealing with future flows. But unfortunately, it's hard to argue, for the free flow of labor as a practical political measure in this climate. It's hard enough to argue even for a fairly, humane immigration reform as something that can be very viable politically. But we need to talk about that humane immigration reform as a thing that we organize for so we can build the political forces that can make it happen a few years from now.
I think the emphasis on this problem as a problem of human rights and, as Hector put it, the humane dimension to this is very important. But I think it's very dangerous to open up the door to any kind of a guest worker program at this point. It's I think there's a number of reasons. Some of them have been mentioned. It's basically and historically been used both here and in other countries as a way to put downward pressure, to beat down wages across the board. I think that we would have to have a lot stronger labor protections for workers in this country and a different kind of political climate before taking the risk of opening the door for guest workers. And quite frankly, my view is that I don't understand what the need is for guest worker programs. You know, all employers are always complaining that they can't get workers, no matter what the kind of situation. But you would expect in a free market economy that if you're paying $6 an hour and you can't get workers, then you got to raise it to $7 an hour or $8 an hour. I mean, that's the way that you bring up the wages at the bottom and improve working conditions at the bottom. But if you're an employer and you can go to the government and say, well, I can't get anybody at $6 an hour, so bring in workers from the Philippines or Mexico or wherever, then it's just sort of a permanent club to keep wages down, and I think that's very dangerous.
Adriana, you work with day laborers in Westchester County. Where do you see if the worst or the middle of these bills pass? What's going to happen to them, and what are they saying? What do you hear them saying?
Well, I think throughout the immigrant community, especially Latin American community, the media have helped build an excessive hope that a guest worker program or legalization program is going to be the solution for day laborers programs that is basically trying to pick up work on the streets and being out of work for long periods of time. I think that we have to be very cautious in the message that we send to the community about the guest worker program or legalization program and put it in a realistic light. These programs have been tried in the past, the Amnesty in 1986, the Bracero program, and they don't take it as a short-term solution that perhaps relieves the pressures and the pain of limited group, really, of immigrants that might be found eligible to apply for the program, but does not take care of the root causes of that migration that is not future, it's constant. It hasn't stopped since the 1940s, and every decade, as a result of yet another unfortunate foreign policy of the United States, a new tide on immigrants comes toward the United States. It's not new, and the solutions are old. I think we need to look at long-term policy solutions that are realistic, that are cover the or protect the individual from having to migrate to leave the country of origin trying to find work in the United States. Another great program problem with this legalization program is that the community has not been told that they need to review the eligibility requirements with care. One of the provisions of the proposed bill limit the eligibility to apply for the potential legalization program for those individuals who were forced to use false documents or give false information in applications. That will leave out thousands, if not millions, of people out of the eligibility to apply for those programs. The hopes that a lot of individuals, day laborers, migrants are working around this legalization program is totally false. And I understand that we need to look at political strategies, that we need to embrace possibilities of building an agenda, but I also think it's necessary on the face of this bill to educate and to invite the community to understand the very law that is going to be applied to them and is going to be ruling their lives. And I think that there's a lot of discussion among advocates about the limitations, the shortcomings of this bill, but I think when I talk to people on the street or with my clients or day laborers in day labor sites, they don't understand really the nefastous effect that as a whole this bill is going to have on them and the ability to survive in this country.
Marianne and Nancy, at least we give you yet more clients for your clinics. I'm continue to be torn between a kind of pragmatic reality politically and an absolute terror that there aren't going to be the kind of amendments that progressive people, that humanists see should be built in, and that, again, I go back to the worst provisions synthesized in these different bills, and I just feel absolutely stymied and filled with trepidation about what is on the horizon.
I think the guest worker situation is one good example of that. I mean, there are proposals which would include a fair amount of worker protection in that kind of a program and give somebody the opportunity to be immigrating in the future. But you have to ask yourself what's going to come out at the end of the day after a conference committee comes together, after the House, which has been adamantly opposed to any such program, is allowed to influence what a program actually looks like. And that's when that kind of a program is one that might look like something that you'd be very worried about. And similarly, on the enforcement side, you have to worry about what would happen with those provisions.
And what would an amendment strategy look like if you had to pick the worst of the enforcement provisions? There are so many. Where would one start? And we definitely need to start looking at how bad they are and the broad sweep of them to begin with. But to go down an amendment strategy that just picks like the two or three or four most egregious, say the enforcement provisions, would still, at the end of the day, leave in the Senate something that could likely pass still with just a whole host of horrible stuff, and then once in conference if passed and in conference with the House, who knows what could be brought up. I'm sure others here could talk more and at greater length about some of the sneaky ways that provisions end up in the bill and catching everybody off guard, and they have this tendency to repeat themselves. If they're defeated one round, they come up again another round, and I think we all, a broad range of immigrant advocates and others, including, by the way, I think this Senate legislation also starts, perhaps for the first time, impacting on U.S. citizens' rights to petition for their family members. We just need to be a lot more vocal about all of that, with the hope that if something is passed and put into conference, people will remember and hesitate before putting all of it in.
Yeah, I don't have much hope that that this thing can be fixed very in the end. I mean, on the you got the political ingredients here are Democrats who are not in control, and as Hector or somebody said, you know, not really decisive or competent, and with a fair amount of hypocrisy thrown in. And then you've got the possibility that in the end, the compromise is between the sort of the right wingers, represented by Sensenbrenger, et cetera, and the business groups led by people like Grover Norquist. So whatever, whether it's an amendment strategy or any other kind of strategy, I would suggest that the best thing that would happen at the end of the day is nothing.
I actually think that the best of the day is nothing is going to happen. It's like, you know, saying that the best of the day is that the sun will come tomorrow, Jeff. I think nothing is going to happen. I think that the question is, as we are fighting for this immigration reform that is not going to happen that we need, out there is a sentiment on the basis, which I think we should not underestimate among the organizing groups, that the actions that took place over the last 3 weeks have actually made a difference. And I think that when we focus a lot on the negative of the Senate bill, we sort of forget that even the negative of the Senate bill is the product of tremendous amount of pressure. And to the extent that we are able to make the nothing that is likely to happen out of this process and turn it into a victory of the people out there on the streets by continuing to talk about the kind of immigration reform we need, the kind of issues that we need in terms of economic social justice here and across the border, and also without forgetting that half of the public is still undecided or is still influenced by those right-wing elements that are using immigration to get elected at the local level. You know, unless we sort of like build a momentum of confidence in the movement right now, it's going to be very difficult for us to change the reality, because once the bill doesn't pass and nothing happens in the Senate and the House, which is a likely outcome, we still are going to have 11 million workers. We're still going to have workers fired because their social security don't match or because their papers are not in place. Workers intimidated from being organized because they don't have documentation. And it's that reality that is out there that is still sufficiently awful that we need to build some confidence in the movement. I think that we need to talk about the bad aspects of the bill. We need to hope for nothing to happen. But we need to build this into a victory of sorts of the movement, blocking the pathway to what would otherwise would have been a very disastrous, legal climate, into a moment to deeply breathe and then figure out how we gain strength so we can eventually win.
You know, I agree with that. I think that beating this bill and having nothing, or maybe at the end something very, very little happen, is a victory. I think that we should declare it a victory, and then having done that, then the question after the election, ought to be, what is it that how is it that we're going to resolve this thing really? And I think you're right. I think the mobilization has been a big step forward. My fear would be that if we get some kind of a bill, and I'm very doubtful we're going to get anything that that reaches your standards, we get some kind of a bill. I would be afraid that the energy and the political spirit that we've seen in the last 3 weeks will be deflated.
Nancy and Marianne and Adriana, I still want to also go back to some of the enforcement provisions. I'm just aghast. Even when I kind of politically understand these things, I continue to have that self-righteous anger that it's some of the most regressive and draconian provisions that I can possibly encompass. And I'm still not sure that people fully understand what is being proposed and what has come out and what it portends for human rights in a country that is made up of, and always has been, of immigrants and immigrant labor and immigrant creativity and sensitivity.
Yeah, well, let's talk about some of them. Ariadna mentioned one that could directly affect the chances of undocumented immigrants ever legalizing their status through any sort of temporary guest worker program, and that's the misuse of misinformation on any, say, Form I-9 to get a job, and basically would be barred from the legalization route and any other regular route to getting status. I mean, people talk about the temporary guest worker provision, but we have to remember that most people who get their status are getting it through regular ways of family immigration because they're married to a U.S. citizen spouse or have a U.S. citizen child, etc. And I think the rate is at around 600,000 adjustments to green card a year. All of those people, if they were to tell the truth in their application of admitting to having used an I-9, will be barred without any kind of...
An I-9?
Yeah, that's the immigration document that one has to submit to get employment. We all sign one of these to get work, and it shows proof of authorization to work in the U.S. But the reality is, and if we ask many people who currently have no status here, is that the authorization isn't there, and to get a job on the books, they will likely have information in there that could now come back to bite them. It is now going to be made a crime. It is now going to bar them from any sort of chance of adjustment of status. But beyond that, again, I just want to talk about all of the ways that this bill affects lawful immigrants, long-time residents, and in ways that just is a redux of the 1996 laws that devastated communities across the country. We have 1.4 million people deported since the 1996 laws, and the result has been devastating. This government has created whole classes of single-parent families where there used to be dual-income households struggling to survive because one parent has been deported for what's considered a criminal ground. And people on both sides of the aisle in Congress after 1996, after they realized how devastating it was, realized their mistake. Oh, my God, what have we done? We should find ways to fix this and provide some humanity into a system that allows people to stay here, recognizing their deep ties. And what this this proposed legislation now does, instead going in the opposite direction, is expanding the bases of deportation that would provide absolutely no chance of a defense based on these family ties. It would create ways to deport people in an expedited manner without even a chance to see an immigration judge. And it basically upends any kind of Supreme Court prohibition against indefinite detention by authorizing the continued detention in perpetuity for people who we can't even deport because their home countries can't take them back or won't take them back.
Hector, I just want...
The other thing I worry about very much is just how how this law would allow enormous profiling, you know, particularly along the border, but everywhere, because the proposals would criminalize. In fact, some laws already criminalize conduct, which is ordinary conduct for people, but then allow very heavy sentences, and that basically gives the government enormous power to bring down the weight of the law against some individuals. None of this is to say there isn't a need for a strong affirmative agenda, but part of the affirmative agenda is to reverse what happened in 96 along with the agenda of creating paths to legalization.
Well, we all should be mad as hell, and what are we going to do about it?
We need to protest against the anti-immigrant climate that has become so pervasive and give us, you know, this type of legislation we've been talking about today, but also to put a proactive agenda that goes back to the core of legalization, of being able to reunite our families, of being able to protect our civil rights and our workers' rights. And even if that sounds a little like nirvana, it's very important to mobilize a community around these issues, because for the last few years, what we have seen since September 11 is really that the movement has not been able to capture sort of public opinion again, and we have been too shy on the shadow of security concerns to put again the demands of the immigrant communities. So I think that in that sense, my comments are more optimistic, because I feel that despite all these bad things happening, I think that we'll be able to build a movement like we haven't seen in quite some time. And this is a great opportunity to put one more stepstone, you know, towards that. Give us what we really need. So please mobilize. We plan to have a meeting of all the people who have been organizing and leading these rallies all over the country. It will be a convention that will take place probably early May in Washington, D.C. or Chicago. It's still being discussed, but we are not going to go away. This is a thing that is going to continue.
Great. And for the enforcement legislation information, you can go to our website, which is www.immigrantdefenseproject.org.
And you can also read The Global Class War by Jeff Foh, so you get the whole background information. And we are going to see the largest human rights movement that this country has seen in decades, and we are going to alter the process and educate the Senate and educate the House and come out with the kind of bill and the kind of immigration process and respect and dignity for human rights, for workers' rights that we should have. This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, with Jeff Foh, who is the author of The Global Class War, Hector Figueroa, Secretary Treasurer, SEIU Local 32BJ, Nancy Morowitz from the NYU School of Law Immigrant Rights Clinics, and Ariana Renteria Torres, Supervising Attorney of the Immigrant Law Unit in Westchester Hispanic Coalition, and Mariana Yang, Director of NYSDA with the Immigrant Defense Project.
This is Mumia Abu Jamal. Immigration blues. Now, as polls show growing disenchantment with both political parties, the issue of immigration is raised once again as politicians seek to stir the pot of social resentment. Voices are raised, tempers are frayed, proposals are launched, and the destinies of millions are apparently held in limbo. But in numbers not seen for generations, mostly Mexican-born or related families pound the pavements in protest, demanding amnesty for the millions who live and work in the most thankless jobs here in the U.S. The immigration discussion masks deeper currents in American life of those who dread the approaching dawn when those who number the nation's majority are brown instead of white. As the government and the servile corporate media hawk fear to trap the nation into the Iraq War, so now fear is once again merchandised for political gain. The perpetual fear of the foreign other, the fear of Spanish-speaking people, who are called criminal for daring to cross the Rio Grande to inhabit the land stolen from their ancestors. The truth of the matter is that it is highly unlikely that over 11 million men, women, and children will be returned to Mexican territory. That's because businesses, especially those engaged in agriculture, would virtually go out of business if their immigrant-based workforce up and disappeared. But like most people, many Latino immigrants are involved in other businesses and industries in U.S. life. Guess who's doing the lion's share of the work to actually rebuild New Orleans? In case you've not guessed, let me just say, it ain't FEMA. With the exception of Native Americans, as in so-called Indians, and African Americans, every person in the U.S. today is a descendant of a willing immigrant. Okay, strict historians will object that many poor whites, especially in the southern states, were sent to Georgia and Maryland as indentured servants in part of a penal sentence. But the point is clear. Immigration was consciously used to craft the U.S. as a white nation. For centuries, certain racial groups, like Chinese, for example, were specifically excluded by law from citizenship. Like their Mexican counterparts, many Asians were needed in the building of this country as cheap labor. Political storms have a way of giving way to political hurricanes that even those who planned them cannot control. Several years ago, a right-wing politician in California tried to ride the anti-immigrant train to the White House. His name was Pete Wilson, and his playing with fire left him politically burnt. Angry Hispanics in Cali sent him and some of his colleagues in the Republican Party into retirement. But this era of politicians trying to create an issue that protects them from the falling numbers of the incumbent Bush administration look at Wilson's fate as ancient history. Perhaps the recent demonstrations, massive in their size, vociferous in their spirit, have given them pause. Time will tell. The political entity that truly befriends this growing segment of the U.S. population will have tapped into a powerful social force. Don't expect it to be either the Republicans or the Democrats. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal, author of We Want Freedom, A Life in the Black Panther Party.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
And this has been Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And you can reach us at knash@igc.org. That's knash@igc.org.